So tonight's talk is based, at least initially, and I'll sort of extrapolate from something called the Nivapa Sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya. And it's a really interesting sutta, and it's one of the examples where the Buddha takes something that everybody would understand who lived in rural India, North India, because pretty much all of North India was rural at that time. And it's like how people would trap deer. And they would trap deer, of course, and then they would eat them. And they did this by putting out bait. And I'll read some of the sutta here. The language is kind of lengthy at times. Bhikkhus, a deer trapper, does not lay down bait for a deer herd, intending thus, may the deer herd enjoy this bait that I have laid down, and so be long-lived and handsome and endure for a long time. In other words, deer trappers don't put out the bait so the deer can enjoy it. Well, not exclusively. A deer trapper lays down bait for a deer herd, intending thus. The deer herd will eat the food unwarily by going right in amongst the bait that I have laid down. By so doing, they will become intoxicated. When they are intoxicated, they will fall into negligence. When they are negligent, I can do with them as I like on account of this bait. So the bait was, there's something in the bait that made the deer wonky, essentially. And he says, a bit further on, he says the interesting thing that I want to read this verse first because it explains the verses I'm about to read. Because I've given this simile in order to convey a meaning. This is the meaning. Bait is a term for sensual pleasure, anything that has sense pleasure involved. Deer trapper is a term for Mara. So Mara, in the cosmology of the time, was like the devil in a sense, but he was a deity who was malevolent and tried to cause problems. There's a classic thing where in another sutta, the Buddha's talking about the time of his enlightenment, and he says, things were arising, and he would just say, "I see you, Mara. Like I see that this is just you." And then Mara would go away because it didn't, what he was doing wasn't working. The deer trapper's following is a term for Mara's following. Deer herd is a term for recluses and Brahmins. In other words, for the deer herd is us, the people who are practitioners of the Dhamma. He describes these four different kinds of deer herds. Now, the deer of the first herd ate food unwarily by going right in amongst the bait that the deer trapper had laid down. By so doing, they became intoxicated. When they are intoxicated, they fell into negligence. When they were negligent, the deer trapper did what with them as he liked on account of that bait. That is how the deer of the first herd failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. So some people, including some Brahmins and recluses, just are get attracted to the pleasurable and can't resist it and get trapped by Mara. So that's one of the four herds. And each of these four herds are symbolic of different kinds of renunciates, different kinds of practitioners in our broader sense. Now, the deer of the second herd reckoned thus. The deer of that first herd, by acting as they did, without precaution, failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. Suppose we altogether shun that bait food, shunning that fearful enjoyment. Let us go into the forests, wilds, and live there. And they did so. But in the last month of the hot season, when the grass and the water were used up, their bodies were reduced to extreme emaciation. With that, they lost their strength and energy. When they lost their strength and energy, they returned to that same bait that the deer trapper had laid down. They ate food unwarily, going right in amongst it, etc. So they thought, well, we're going to avoid this by being very austere and living in the wilds away from all any kind of food. Didn't work. Now the deer of the third herd reckoned thus. The deer of the first herd, by acting as they did without precaution, failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. The deer of that second herd, by reckoning how the deer of the first herd had failed, and by planning and acting as they did with precaution of going to live in the forest wilds, also failed to get free from the deer trapper's power and control. Suppose we make our dwelling place within the range of the deer trapper's bait. Then, having done so, we should eat food not unwarily and without going right in amongst the bait that the deer trapper has laid. By doing so, we shall not become intoxicated. When we are not intoxicated, we shall not fall into negligence. So they're going to sort of hang out on the edge of this bait. But then the deer trapper and his following considered thus. These deer of this herd, third herd, are as cunning and crafty as wizards and sorcerers. They eat the bait laid down without our knowing how they come and go. Suppose we have the bait that is laid down completely surrounded all around over a wide area with wicker hurdles. Then perhaps we might see the third herd, deer herd's dwelling place where they go to hide. They did so, and they saw the third herd's hiding place where they went to hide, and this is how the deer of the third herd also failed to get free. So now it's like this third herd is like, well, we better sort of be right on the edge and not get too close. And this, and one of the things that deer trappers did is there'd be a whole bunch of them, and they'd make these big wicker hurdles, wicker walls, and they would slowly enclose the herd, and then the herd would get trapped. So, now the fourth herd. Now the deer of the fourth herd reckoned thus. Deer of that first herd, by acting as they did, etc. The deer of the second herd, by reckoning how the deer of the first herd had failed, and by planning and acting as they did, with precaution, by going to live in the forest wilds, also failed. And the deer of that third herd, by reckoning how the deer of the first herd and also the deer of the second herd had failed, and by planning and acting as they did with precaution and making their dwelling place within range of the deer trapper's bait, also failed to get free of the deer trapper's power and control. Suppose we make our dwelling where the deer trapper and his following cannot go. Then, having done so, we shall eat food that the deer trapper has laid down. By doing so, we shall not become intoxicated, etc. So they're saying, well, we're going to be in a place where the deer trapper can't go. So beyond the range of the deer trapper's capabilities. And that's what the deer trapper, the fourth herd did, and got free of the deer trapper's power and control. So this is a long extended simile, right, or metaphor. Never get those two straight. And so, first of all, the first herd is like people, like I said, who just like hung in amongst the bait and just did whatever they wanted. And this is like what he's talking about here. There were people who were, quote, recluses in the day. Because remember, in the Buddhist time, there were lots of different traditions. These were recluses who said, we don't have to worry about getting caught by pleasurable things. We can just do whatever we want. We can just have all the pleasure we want, and that'll be okay, because that's just the way things are. There's nothing wrong with pleasure, ever. We should just get as much of it as we can all the time. And they got caught because, you know, they were fooling themselves, right? And in the sutta, there are places in the Buddha where the Buddha criticizes people who went forth, i.e., took monastic orders, simply to enjoy life where they didn't have to work, and people felt obligated to take care of them and feed them. This is also, there were people who monastics who did just this. I'm a monastic, and people felt, you know, that was their duty of the householder was to feed these people. So these people, and make sure they had, you know, a robe and a nice hut to stay in, sort of thing. And these people just took full advantage of this and had all of, and just lazed about and ate regularly and never did any work at all. That's the first group of renunciates that he's talking about. So this is the second herd is people who go off into the total wilds and don't have any regular food. In other words, you know, they go beyond where people can give them dana. They can't do dana rounds because they're too far out from where people are, and so they eat what's there. And this is like these people were renunciates who believed in extreme austerity. It's like, let's just see how much we can suffer. I mean, they understood, they did have the understanding that they had to sort of somehow overcome suffering and stood its source and that sort of thing. But they said, if we just suffer enough, we'll understand suffering. But and the Buddha tried this approach. I mean, you know, when the Buddha first ran away from home, he first went off and learned concentration practices from two different teachers, and became their essentially their co-teachers. But it wasn't they. But the Buddha realized, nah, this concentration is wonderful, but it's not enough. And then he went off and hung out with these guys in the forest in great austerity. And there's a place in the sutta where the Buddha describes this time. He's talking to Sariputta, one of his main disciples, and describing his life as a recluse in this way. It's pretty extreme. Sariputta, there are certain recluses and Brahmins whose doctrine and view is this: purification comes through food. They say, let us live on kola fruits. And they eat kola fruits, they eat kola fruit powder, they drink kola fruit water, and they make many kinds of kola fruit concoctions. Now, I recall having eaten a single kola fruit a day. So this is like one piece of fruit a day. You may think that the kola fruit was bigger at that time, but you should not regard it so. The kola fruit was then at most the same size as now. So this is like the size of the end of your thumb, apparently. Though feeding on a single kola fruit a day, my body reached a state of extreme emaciation. Because of eating so little, my limbs became like the jointed segments of vine stems or bamboo stems. Because of eating so little, my backside became like a camel's hoof, like hard, right? Because of eating so little, the projections on my spine stood forth like corded beads. Because I'm eating so little, my ribs jutted out as gaunt as the crazy rafters of an old roofless barn. Because of eating so little, the gleam of my eyes sank far down in their sockets, looking like the gleam of water that was sunk far down in a deep well. Because of eating so little, my scalp shriveled and withered as a bitter green gourd shrivels and withers in the wind and sun. Because of eating so little, my belly skin adhered to my backbone. So he had so little flesh that his belly skin actually stuck onto his backbone, right? Thus, if I wanted to touch my belly skin, I encountered my backbone. If I wanted to touch my backbone, I encountered my belly skin. Because of eating so little, if I wanted to defecate or urinate, I fell over on my face right there. In other words, he couldn't even eliminate. Because of eating so little, if I tried to ease my body by rubbing my limbs with my hands, the hair, rotted at its roots, fell from my body as I rubbed. So this is how extreme the Buddha practiced. He's like, he was like determined to suffer enough that he would understand suffering. And then at a certain point, he went, and he was actually hanging out in the forest with five other guys who were doing the same thing. And at a certain point, he just went, wait a second, this isn't working. And you know, the famous story, he walked away from the other five, and they were, you know, yelling at him, oh, there's that backslider, Buddha, you know, Gautama. And he actually met the milkmaid by the river, and she gave him a bowl of rice porridge, and he ate the rice porridge, and he realized that this is what he needed to do. And then he came and found what he called the middle way, which was the balance between extremity and license, which are the first. So the first two groups are sort of like two extremes that you could take in your practice. One is, I can do whatever I want. And the other is like, well, I'm going to be like, make myself totally miserable all the time. Neither of these work as ways to practice. So then there's the third group. And this is like we'll live close to the bait and we'll nibble at it a little bit, but you know, we're going to sort of keep away from it as much as we can. And in the suttas, the Buddha compares this herd to a group of renunciants who get caught up in dense philosophical talk, debating what are considered unanswerable questions, and thus distracted and caught. And this is another whole way that people take the practice. They take the practice as an intellectual exercise, not a problem to try and understand things, not a problem to study. But what he's talking about, you see this in many places in the Sutta, the Buddha talks about, here's certain things that are unanswerable and you shouldn't waste your time. If you're going to spend time practicing instead of trying to answer these unanswerable questions. You know, how does the universe begin? How will the universe end? You know, there's another one where, you know, what happens after death? Those sorts of things, just don't bother debating them, trying to figure them out. This is what a lot of Western philosophy does, by the way, and from my point of view. Anyway, they sort of figure, I'm going to, you know, intellectually figure out things and then write it all down, and everybody's going to, you know, I've got the answer. And it doesn't work. It's like, it's good to study, it's good to have some understanding of the teachings, but it doesn't work to sort of, your whole way of practice is the figuring out way, because it using the wrong side of your brain, among other things. The brain has a side that is intellectual and studies and reads, and there's another side of your brain that gets activated when you're still and away from the words and just still and focused and silent. Two different aspects of the brain. And so this is interesting in the sense that he's sort of describing things. Then the fourth way, the fourth deer, move away from the bait and live in a place where the deer trapper can't go. What does that mean, a deer trapper? Where can Mara not go? And this is the group who follow the middle way and through intense practice reach mind states where the power of the bait no longer arises, where, you know, all those pleasurable things, you just don't attract you anymore, don't affect you. You're not tempted by them because they're just, you see them for what they are, things that are impermanent and unsatisfactory, and just, they're still there. Yes, they are enjoyable, but they're not the way to reach, to achieve anything other than, you know, you still eat because you have to eat to stay alive, so that's the middle way. You're eating carefully, you're eating very plain food. You know, they ate very simply once a day. But you're only doing it to stay alive. It's pretty severe, right? I mean, and, you know, they're not cooking, they're not storing food overnight, they're not asking for special food, but they're making sure that they actually do eat food and that they have clean water and that they take care of their bodies and they have a robe and even will get medicine from the village. Part of the householder's job, if you want, part of the dana they gave was to give cloth to make robes and to give medicine when required for people who renunciates who need medicine. But how does this apply to us? I mean, he's talking about renunciates here, right? What about us householders? How does these images, these herds of deer, apply to the householder life? And I think there are four distinct categories of householder practitioners that very nicely fit into the four kinds of deer herds. And but before we go there, one choice we could make, if we really wanted to be very serious about the practice, is we could become renunciates. And we could become monks and nuns. There are monasteries and nunneries in the world that are in this tradition, in England and in the United States, and one in Switzerland, I understand. And it may even seem appealing in a way because it's like, oh, then I don't have to worry about all this other stuff that I have to worry about, because that people take care of me. That's part of being a renunciate, is you get taken care of. But the life of a renunciate is really, really difficult, and this suits, my notes say here, is the best way for a very small number of people. There are people, look at Bhikkhu Bodhi and people like that. Some of the books I read from are, the people who translated this thing, Bhikkhu Nama and Bhikkhu Bodhi. These are renunciates who did this great service by doing new translations of the main teachings of the Buddha and published them. So there's lots of people who do that, but it's a rare person who can live a full, really live the life of a renunciate. Most of us are destined to be regular people. So what about us regular people? And we can think of the ideas behind the first three deer herds as warnings, in a sense, of what we need to watch out for in our practice. I think it's a good way to look at it. To say, here's things that we have to be aware of where we could, get caught by Mara, essentially, in the modern sense of that word. And the first herd looks quite familiar, right? And, this is the whole basis of hippies. I can talk about hippies as I was one. Imagine me in patched blue jeans and macrame suspenders and a matching macrame headband and an afro. I mean, that's 50 odd years ago, but that's, and basically the whole hippie culture was, I'm so spiritual, I love everyone, let's get stoned. That summed up the philosophy in, and it was just like, and then also there were people. There was what I know known as called so-called spiritual groups, who gurus claim that the way to understand craving and overcome it is to indulge in as much as you can. This was, maybe some of you might remember the name Bhagwan Rajneesh. I had friends who went and followed him because it was like his ashrams were like one big party all the time, and it was like fun to be a follower of Rajneesh, but in the end, it went way south. I think that's a polite way of putting it. But they all thought they were very special because they wore orange robes and they were going to change the world because they understood. And you see the same string today. Like just very recently, I ran into a person who actually came to a few of my talks and one of my day-longs. But she adopted an indigenous culture that's practiced by taking hallucinogens. And that was her practice. That was like one of her main part of her practice was, but it was like spiritual because it was indigenous, right? It's really makes, you know. And it doesn't work. And I'm not saying that hallucinogens are bad. I consumed my fair share of them in my day. But in the end, it just doesn't go anywhere because it just you don't learn to get there yourself. You only learn to consume these things and have a wonderful time. And I had some pretty powerful experiences. And to be honest with you, I probably wouldn't have gone along the road I've gone on to end up being here without having done that first. I would have been a very straight businessman taking care of, you know, my house in the suburbs kind of guy. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I grew up in a very sort of conservative working class family, blue collar, and you know, the whole world revolved around getting a good job and making money and you know, doing all the things you're supposed to do with it. And doing hallucinogens sort of woke me up in a sense. And it was fun, but then about 2 years of it was enough. I went, no, this doesn't really work at all. And then there's people, and I back meet people like this too. This the second group. There's people who say, I'm spiritual, but I don't need any sort of practice. I'm spiritual, but I don't need to do anything about it. I'm a good person. I'm spiritual. End of discussion. Doesn't go anywhere. There's no progression. They're sort of stuck in this idea that they're spiritual. And they may be quite wonderful people, but nothing, it's not going anywhere. And then there's the other, the second herd in our groups of teachings that you'll run into in the spiritual traditions in here in the West, where the idea of severe restraint is essential to, in becoming part of the group. If you want to be part of this group, you have to sort of really knuckle down and be serious and severe and kind of grim. And this is also often a way for the leaders of these groups to control the people who join. Because there's this, you have to be this way and you have to lead this really extreme life. And if you don't, then you get shunned. You're not part of the group anymore. And people get buy into and become happy in a sense because they're part of some special thing, or so they're told. And this is Jamestown in this extreme. But it's also things like, the Catholic Church, from my point of view, where you have to follow these rules, and if you don't follow these rules, you're going to burn in hell for all eternity. That's a more common version of the same thing. And I'm not saying that Christianity is bad or shouldn't be a Christian or follow Christian teachings. It's just that you have to be careful to not buy into the wagging finger part of it. I mean, what Jesus said had no wagging finger. Just reading the Sermon on the Mount had no wagging fingers there. But the institutional forms of the Jesus' teaching became like the second herd. And And part of many of these groups also insist on celibacy. Catholic Church for priests and nuns. Once again, not that that celibacy is bad for some few people. It's a very legitimate way to sort of tune in to deeper things by not being, like, letting go of that distraction completely. But this is once again a very small number of people who can successfully live that way. And it doesn't work for most people. But it's often within these groups I'm talking about who are emulate the second herd is part of the deal. Yeah. There was a spiritual group that was up in upper New York State and was like this, and people were there, and the teacher kept saying, no, you all have to be celibate, and it's really important to be celibate. And it turns out, of course, that he's now, they found out eventually, and the whole thing went south, that he'd been sleeping with several of his students. You know, everybody should be celibate except me, you know, and these few select people. Right, you know. So there's a lot of that danger as well. And then there's the third herd, the group of you of people who come close to the bait and study and, you know. And there are all kinds of spiritual traditions, philosophies in the world today that householders are part of, where this is how it works. It's like if I can just following and trying to understand what's being said, I can figure it all out. I can approach this from through endless debate and obscure ideas and get to the right answer, and I will be one of those gifted people who are smart enough to figure it out. It's very ego building, right? And what happens, of course, is people in these groups believe they've got it figured out, and those other people who don't have it figured out aren't anywhere near as good. And only that they're wrong because they figured it out in a different way. We see a lot of this in the world today too. So the question then is, how do we emulate the fourth herd while living in the world as householders? You know, we're not going to go, you know, live someplace where there's nothing, there's no temptations. Every time, you know, we're householders, we go to the grocery store. Talk about a world of temptations. I mean, it's like all these glossy packaging and things. It's just endless. And so to do this as a householder, and the Buddha talked about this a lot as well. He said it all has to start simply by leading a virtuous life. That's where it has to begin. We're not going to be renunciates, we're not going to be celibate, we're householders. We're going to live the life of a normal householder. But we're going to lead a life of virtue. That's where it has to start. And we do that by making virtue a practice. You know, we don't, it's so easy to fall into the place of, well, I know I'm a good person and I'm virtuous and I don't have to think about it anymore. Actually, we have to think about it all the time. Every day, when as we're just going through life and we are making choices, our choices have to be based on, is this virtuous or not? Is this the right thing to do? Based on our limited knowledge. So of course we're going to mess up and make mistakes. That's why they call it practice, right? We have to practice virtue. And then we can practice what the Buddha taught. Like we're doing tonight, and like sitting, regular sitting practice, and going on retreat, and all these things we do. And we get to an understanding that the world of the five senses, as wonderful as they can be, and I'm not for one second denying, I just, before I came here, I ate this great supper. I had homemade pizza and a big salad I made from things in the garden. I was, oh. It's not like we shouldn't enjoy things, but it doesn't lead to true happiness. They're temporary. I think I've got my garden, for instance. My garden is great right now. 2 months from now, if I'm lucky, there might still be a few collards up there. That'll be about it. It's gone. Just like that. Things rise, they're there for a while, and they're gone. Gardens are a real good lesson in that, to go through this cycle every year. And then we can find a place where eventually we start to see that because everything is arising and passing away, that everything is changing all the time, that there's nothing, no matter how wonderful it looks on the outside, that's going to make us happy in the long-term sense, because it's all going to go away. Nothing's permanent. We start to see clearly the three characteristics, that things are impermanent. Because they're impermanent, they're unsatisfactory. We go, oh. This starts to be not just words. It starts to be not just an intellectual understanding, but an experience that we come to over and over and over again. We start to see everything changing all around us all the time. And we start to see the unsatisfactoriness of it all. As wonderful as that meal was, I ate with the food from my garden, it's gone. And I'll never have that meal again. And who knows if I'll ever have that meal at all. Things change all the time. So we get to the place where the bait just doesn't seem as attractive. And this is a very gradual process. Like, we would like it to be instantaneous. We'd like to just, oh, I want to be in a place where I'm never tempted by the bait anymore. But we're human. And life isn't like that. We are going to be, if we live in the world as we do, as householders, we're going to be confronted with those things over and over and over and over. And gradually over time, they just have less allure. And fewer of them are alluring. I mean, I used to think going out to the bar and getting drunk was just like the best thing in the world back in my 20s. And now it's like, I think, how can people even do that? It doesn't even like connect in my brain that it might be fun. It was just like, it's just totally miserable. But, that took a number of years to get to the point where I went, no, I'm not going to do that anymore. I was in my late 20s before I figured that one out. And that, no, this doesn't work. Anyhow, but that's what we do. We gradually see things more and more clearly, because that's what the life of a householder is. It's gradual, step by step by step, little tiny steps. And it's one other thing I think is really important, and that's the power of Sangha. The Sangha, gathering together with other people of like mind, is our herd. This is our herd. Tonight we got a small herd. This is a herd. And it's important that we keep remembering that. That if we hang out with people of like mind who are interested as we are interested in practicing and studying the Dhamma, it encourages us to continue practicing and studying the Dhamma. That's the power of being in this particular herd. And it's like I'm constantly thankful that I'm not trying to do this all alone. That I have all kinds of people I can be with and hang out with and study with and in my case teach But you know, a while ago something happened, and the first thing I did is I phoned David Chernikov, and we talked on the phone for half an hour because he was part of my sangha. I knew he could help me resolve this thing. That's just the power of sangha, and it's not like anyone is beyond the need for that. We all need sangha. I did want to read something. This is an interesting tidbit. Like, we're talking about how we can practice in daily life. And this is something that Joseph Goldstein wrote in Insight Meditation. And I've always liked this little section because it's so practical. The thing I like about Joseph, he's one of these very down-to-earth practical people in a lot of ways. He says, how can we remain present and mindful when we move from a meditation sitting or a meditation retreat to our other activities in the world? Making that crucial transition from awareness on the cushion to awareness in daily activities fundamentally affects our freedom. Practicing mindfulness of the body is one of the easiest ways to stay present in daily life. This mode of awareness works so well that the Buddha devoted many teachings to it. He said that mindfulness of body leads to nirvana, to freedom, to the unconditioned. So through this practice, though it's very simple, it is in no way trivial or superficial. Our body is quite obvious as an object of attention, not subtle like thoughts or emotions. We can stay aware of the body easily, but only if we remember to do so. Key thing, I know. So we have to actually remember to practice. The remembering is difficult, not the awareness. Very true. Remember to use your body as a vehicle for awakening. It can be as simple as staying mindful of your posture. You're probably sitting as you read this book or listen to this Dharma talk. What are the sensations in your body at this moment? When you put the book down and stand, feel the movement of standing, of walking to the next activity, of how you lie down at the end of the day. Be in your body as you move, as you reach for something, as you turn. It's as simple as that. Staying present in the body is one reason that walking meditation has been so helpful to my own practice. After doing it for thousands of hours over many years, it actually becomes quite natural to feel the movement of my feet and legs as I walk. That habitual presence with the sensation of walking grounds my awareness in other parts of everyday life. You do not have to practice walking meditation or any other mindfulness of body for hundreds or thousands of hours to feel the benefit. Just patiently practice feeling what is there, and the body is always there. Until it becomes second nature to know even the smallest movements you make. If you're reaching for something, you're doing it anyway. There's nothing extra you have to do. Simply notice the reaching. You're moving. Can you train yourself to be there, to feel it? It is very simple. Practice again and again, bringing your attention back to your body. This basic effort, which paradoxically is our relaxing back into the moment, gives us the key to expanding our awareness from times of formal meditation to living mindfully in the world. Do not underestimate the power that comes to you from feeling the simple movements of your body throughout the day. It's like such, it makes it sound so simple. Of course, as he said, you know, the hard part is remembering to do this. But even if it's like every once in a while, you know, you can make certain things that are keys that remind you. Every time you walk through a door, as you're walking through the door, can you just be mindful of, oh, I'm walking through a door. Every time I open a door, I have to reach and grasp and pull. It's a whole series of actions. Can I just set the intention to try and be mindful every time I open a door? How many times a day do we do that? Open doors or close doors or turn on our cell phones. Or turn on our computers, in my case. You know, it's like, can we at that moment just be mindful? Even if it's just, oh, you can feel the sensations of it as you're doing it. It can be really simple things. And you can start with like that, just pick one particular thing that you do a lot of, and set the intention to be, I'm gonna, every time I do that, I'm gonna try and be mindful of the actual physical sensations of doing it. And it's like now you're back constantly all day long having little moments of mindfulness, which over time accumulate into longer spaces in between. You open the door, and then you're paying attention to walking through the door, then you're paying attention to closing the door, and then you're paying attention to sitting down in the chair in that room you just went into. You know, see where I'm going here. You can start like noticing more and more things. And that's all we can do. You know, it's just like you start to make our practice in daily life by formalizing it a little bit, which is what Joseph was getting at here. I just lost my other book. It's over here, that's why. I came across this poem. I mean, reading this book, One Soul, More Poems from the Heart of Yoga by Dana Falls. And I came across this poem that I really like, that sort of points very clearly to what practice is actually like. And I thought I'd share just because I, as I read this, I went, oh yeah, that sounds pretty familiar. So. This is called Another Meditation Poem. I try to meditate, and my mind races like a rodent through a maze. It's got no place to hide, no corner for retreat. It doesn't like to face itself head on. Instead of focusing on technique, my mind begins to write a poem. I repeat a Sanskrit chant, but that gets lost in the whirl of unrelated thoughts. I concoct a vivid soap opera in my mind that then lose track of the story's thread and redesign the bedroom. My senses search for anything alluring, the sound of wind, the far-off raucous call of crows, the feel of blankets on my knees. Just when I'm convinced it's time to trudge off in defeat, there is a momentary opening, a second of pure stillness. Thoughts rush back in, but I know that there's a reason to persist in sitting. Something slowly shifts. Now, mind you, this lasts only for the briefest instant, but I know myself as whole. No fireworks, no drama, no territory gained, just a breath or two when all that isn't true falls away, and the spaciousness that remains stuns the mind to silence. This is why I choose to sit. It's not about distant victory. No, meditating is here and now, and a very present glimpse of all that is, a chance to just be whole. It's a I think this is a wonderful description of meditation and what happens. And it's those moments, and we all have those moments where we go, there's those moments of still and calm that are so sweet. And as she said, it might last us for a second or two, but it tells us this, that's accessible, that's real, it's right there, if we just let ourselves pay attention to it. Reminds me of something that happened to me. Just on I think either my very first 10-day retreat or my second 10-day retreat, very early on in my practice. And I was sitting, and it's one of those sittings where it's like, when are they going to ring the damn bell? I'm going crazy, I'm uncomfortable, I have to keep, I'm fidgety, I'm just like, I'm totally fixated on when are they going to ring the bell? It's like my whole mind is just full of that idea, to the exclusion of pretty much anything else other than that my knees ache, right? Then Boom, the bell rings. And at that moment, all what I was watching, desiring, was gone. And I just, for, I don't know, 5 seconds, 10 seconds, was like, ah. It was so sweet just because they rang the bell. And now I didn't have to want it anymore. And it was like, oh, this is available too. This calm stillness is one of those moments where I learned that calm stillness was actually available. And doing the practice, this in spite of my totally inexpert ranting to myself about why don't they ring the damn bell, there it was. Just like that. That's what she's talking about in her poem. I think that's something we have to remember, is that that's the nature of this practice in a way. It's like a little bit, little bit, little bit, little that's all we can hope for. So that's what I have to share tonight.